we don't really know what we're doing or what we're talking about.
That's right, we don't know either, so it'll be great.
Okay. And welcome to Somewhere in Between, the podcast for early career GPs and AIT trainees. My name's Mira. I'm an ST3 working in South London, and I'm joined by with my other wonderful podcasting host, Johannes. Hi, Johannes.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I've got a confession to make. We are currently recording this podcast at about 17 minutes to 9 o'clock at night on a dreary November evening. So bear with us as we stumble over our words, but we decided we would sacrifice our love for Bake Off and come and do something a little bit different this afternoon, this evening even. And we have two very special guests joining us today who are actually going to be taking control of the podcast. So we've got Emma and Bex, who are both foundation trainees. Emma is an academic F2 trainee and Bex is an F3, currently working with Health Education England and in ED. And the thing is, they are both thinking about applying for general practice this year, which is very exciting. So they're kind of going to take control, ask us some questions, going to discuss a little bit about why GP, and we'll take it from there, I think. But before we go into that, Johannes, I must ask you this question. Favorite Bake Off person so far? Have you got a favorite?
I have immediately forgotten everyone's name, but obviously I'm kind of Team Germany.
Oh, you're a Jürgen fan.
I'm a little bit of a Jürgen fan, just because he's a bit odd as well, and I love it when people are just a little bit odd.
Yeah, I mean,
what about you?
So I love Jürgen. I think Giuseppe is fantastic, and I think Christelle is very talented. I think they're all talented. Let's be honest, I couldn't bake any of those things, and I would cry miserably at like everything collapsing in an oven. So at the moment, I just sort of watch them and judge, but I have no reason to judge because I have no skills. But Christelle and Giuseppe, I think, for me. But let's crack on. Let's talk about baking, more chat about GP. So Emma, Bex, over to you.
Thanks, Mira. Thanks, Johannes, for having us on this evening. It's really brilliant to have the opportunity to gain a bit of an insight into your lives as trainees and hopefully shed a bit of light on those who are, like us, looking to apply to GP very soon or in the future. Bex, I just wondered if you wanted to start off by telling us a little bit about your thought process and thinking about GP before we go and ask Mira and Johannes.
Yeah, so I've always been Team GP, literally from day one medical school, because on my work experience placements, hospital, I just found so dreary, and everyone's just a little bit sad in hospital. And then you come to GP and people are just so much more energized. There's this great team working with patients, really one-on-one with patients that you don't get anywhere else. And this continuity of care, I've never seen patients who love their doctors more than patients love GPs. And throughout medical school, it just solidified for me that I love GP. And my F2 placement, yes, it was hard at times in GP. Over winter, of course, it was difficult. But I just find that relationship you get with the patient, you don't get anywhere else. And the autonomy of GP and the ability to do more than just one role. With GP, you can literally do almost anything you want to do alongside GP, or you can just do GP because it's a fantastic career. So for me, really, GP just solidifies everything I want to do and everything I want to be as a doctor. So I can't really see any other pathway. What about you, Emma? What's your thing with GP? Why do you love it so much?
Yeah, thanks, Bex. I completely agree a lot of what you're saying with regards to the variety. And I think the beauty of the consultation, I think, is really humbling to be sat in a room where you have that really one-on-one relationship, but you're also working with a really fantastic team around you. But I think what's most special for it in a lot of ways is that you're almost a pillar in the community, that you see people interacting with their lives in their area, in their space, and that allows them to really open up to you and to offer them more. It links into all the things with social prescribing and about the wider social terms of health and everything else that's going on in someone's life. It's a really wonderful window and a wonderful opportunity and a very satisfying opportunity to be able to help them in that way. For me, I know that I need a career that has a lot of variety. I want to be a generalist, but an expert medical generalist, and to cover lots of different aspects. I don't want to do lots of one thing. I don't want to be the super specialist. It's not what works for me and my personality. And actually, the opportunity to go through a career and be able to pursue academia and medical education, to do lots of different things and have so many different opportunities. I mean, for me, I'm definitely going to be involved in commissioning and the policy side of things and the wider societal impact. And that's where it's a really brilliant place to sit in society and to be able to contribute to that. But it's also a really challenging place. And I think that you speak to different GPs and they all have completely different experiences and a different journey, but they're all wonderful journeys and they're all very inspiring. They're all very personal to them, but also you can see the impact and the care they have for their patients. And I think that's really magical. And I remember I did lots of things in general practice, looking through my GP society and through my faculty board and all the things I did up in Yorkshire when I was training in Leeds. But I remember going to the annual conference one year and Helen Stokes Lampard was talking about Enid-shaped care. And it very much reminded me of a story that I'd written about in my personal statement about the power of the consultation and about the ability that you have and that pure privilege to sit there as a doctor and to be part of somebody's life and to help them. And it just solidified it at that point. And everything that I found out I can do since is just bonus and bonus and bonus. Miro, would you mind sharing with us your thoughts on why you chose GP?
I mean, you guys have put so many wonderful points through so eloquently. I think we're almost not even needed here, Johannes. But I guess, personally speaking, for me, interestingly, I was never Team GP. I started medical school, now feels like a very long time ago, and always thought a bit about surgery, helped my friend co-found the surgical society at my university. Quickly realised in a third year placement that surgery was not for me at all. I just didn't want to stand for 9 hours at a time. It was just not the thing. And then really thought about sort of medicine and hospital medicine. And, you know, I think, Bex, you said something about, you know, hospital feeling a bit dreary. But for me, it was the opposite. I found it very exciting. And I was like, oh, if I want to do a test, I can do it now. And if I want to order a scan, I can do that. Well, as a lowly F1, F2, maybe not with the click of my fingers, but, you know, to the best of that ability. So I actually did an academic foundation program with a special interest in medical education up in the north of England. Really, really enjoyed that. And then had a GP job in my F2, which I utterly despised. And I think it's really important to talk about that because I think there are such amazing, wonderful things about general practice and hospital medicine, but there are equally not so good things about both. And it's really important when you're, personally, my advice is when you're going through foundation training, when you're going through your medical school placements, when you're thinking about your electives or your special selected components, that you don't necessarily allow one experience to shape your entire mindset about a career. I remember being sat in a lecture theatre in medical school and people sort of one of the lecturers saying, who here wants to do general practice? And I think in a lecture hall of about maybe 80 of us, four people put their hands up. And the lecturer said, well, actually, when you all graduate, I can guarantee that at least a third, if not more of you will end up doing general practice. And I couldn't ever imagine being a part of that third. And now here I am. So how did that happen? So I finished academic training and thought, what am I going to do? Applied for core medical training and decided to come down to London, which was a whole new start for me. I'd never really worked in a big city before. I'd never lived in London before. So that was in itself quite a big transition and change. And I did 2 years of core medical training, as it was back then. And I enjoyed my jobs. Don't get me wrong. I really enjoyed working in cardiology or gastro or respiratory. But I remember having this distinct feeling of being sat in teaching sessions or being on a ward round and thinking and just having this sort of sense of unease of, I don't think I belong here. And I couldn't tell you exactly what it was. It wasn't that I was, you know, turning up late or being told off or, you know, everyone had a busy rota. Everyone was working nights. But I just wasn't satisfied. There was something about it that just wasn't quite doing it for me. And I could see the satisfaction that my other colleagues were getting, and they knew they wanted to do cardiology, they knew they wanted to do gastro, and I thought, okay, I don't quite know. And for someone who had gone straight through A-level, straight through university, straight through foundation training, now in a sort of core medical training position, I was like, oh, it's the first time I ever felt uncertain about something. So I decided to take a year out. The plan was to travel, but then I met my now husband, so travel plans got a little bit scuppered. And in the meantime, I took a post as a locum registrar in a palliative care job, and I loved it. It was a total turning point for me. And I had realized, whilst I'd been going through the motions of being a doctor for the best part of 2 years, I'd lost my sort of love and passion for the job that I actually had inside me, and I didn't really realize I'd lost. And getting that time to speak to people at a very critical time of anybody's life, but that it's an absolute privilege to be a part of with that person, their relatives, the friends and family that are important to that person. And, you know, truly working in a collaborative way, you know, a patient-centered way, doing something that day in and day out, I really looked forward going to work. And that was a sensation I hadn't felt for some time. And I thought, oh, gosh, maybe palliative care, is that what's for me? But I also then realized it's that specific task and role, which kudos to all my palliative care colleagues out there. It's incredible. I didn't know if it was necessarily something I wanted to do all the time. So I had a long think and thought, what's a specialty that will bring me all the things that I talked about that brought my joy back into medicine, but had a bit of variety as well, so that I could do palliative care, which I still do, you know, what do quite a lot at my practice at the moment, but has a remit of other things as well. And so it was general practice, and that's what led me to apply. So I guess that's a very long way of saying I never thought I wanted to do GP, but I'm so, so glad that I did it. How about you, Johannes?
Just going to say, Mira, I wonder if now that you've summarised it so nicely at the end, if Bryn's just going to chop the whole inspirational story out and just use the conclusion. So my story is in some ways very similar and in others quite different. So I came to medicine a lot later. I was 28 when I started medical school. And I think what I learned from all of my previous careers is just that I do get quite itchy feet. And I did quite enjoy, both in medical school and in foundation training, kind of moving through on rotation and constantly having something fresh. And as it got towards the end of F2, I just started thinking, you know, how am I going to maintain this level of kind of interest and complexity in terms of the roles that I'm doing? And there were lots of other jobs that appealed to me. I wasn't kind of dead set on doing GP. But when I looked at my other options, I kind of couldn't find anything that would give me the flexibility and the ability to mold my own career and potentially just to completely pivot at some point and say, I'm going to do a diploma in dermatology and become, you know, a GP with an interest in dermatology and just kind of completely swerve off to a new track, which you can do in other medical careers completely, but I feel like GP is more designed for you to kind of own it. And I think that also reflects on what you were saying earlier, Mira, about not judging individual GP experiences when you're deciding about your career. Because if you think about when you walk into a general practice, if it's a partnership model type of a practice, that's someone's baby, which they've crafted according to, you know, what makes them and the other partners tick. And it can be a really personal environment for them. So I think it's really important to kind of, if you're maybe unsure and if you haven't had a completely convincing experience of GP, just find out what the other options are. I know in London, there are some really kind of big, highly efficient models of GP, and for some personality types, that's really good. And for other people, you want, you know, much more small kind of cottagey practice where it's maybe a bit more intimate and a bit more old fashioned. And equally, you might want to work with different populations. So sometimes you'll work in a GP practice that has a lot of older patients, and that can suit some people, particularly if you're interested in managing chronic conditions and palliative care. at the moment I'm working in a practice with an incredibly young population, and that brings, you know, a whole other set of challenges, and you can tailor the career in so many different ways, you know, through choosing a practice and through choosing a patient population and choosing how you operate your career. And all of those things really, really appeal to me. So, I mean, Samira and I, you know, we're still in training, so we still haven't kind of put firm roots down, but through training, it's a really nice process of being able to kind of explore your interests and explore what does make you tick and what works for you. And that's probably the most important thing for me about GP.
Thank you both. It's really interesting to hear how we've got four people and there's all these common themes that run through everybody's stories, but everyone also has completely different things that they put in. So it's really nice to hear about everyone's variety and everyone's experiences as well. And it solidifies the fact that one person is not a GP. There's a whole range of people who are GPs. And even if it's something that you think, oh, I don't really fit the mold, there is no mold, you just make the mold. And I think that's shown from all four stories. So one of the things that comes up a lot with GPs, and a word that is banded around a lot, is a portfolio career. So Mira and Johannes, in your opinions, what is a portfolio career? Do you guys do portfolio careers through training as well, or is that only something you can do when you're qualified? And have you guys got any plans going forward of what you'd like to do, what your normal week is going to look like when you are qualified?
And just to add on to that, I know it's something that trainees are really interested in when they're looking to apply to different specialties, is how can they pursue their specialist interest still, but in a general medical field? And it's just something you said, Mira, about palliative care. Building on what Bex asked, can you talk about how you're managing to pursue that through your training and how you see that looking in your future as well?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of working as a portfolio GP, because I think that you're right, that word is bandied about a lot. I think the main take home from me entering GP training is actually realizing every GP is a portfolio career GP, and recognizing that what that means to people is different. So having a portfolio career in a sense is that, yes, there are some aspects of it which are face-to-face clinical work, or remote during the pandemic, or however it is that you fashion your clinical work. Some of it is because you have a special interest in a particular specialty. Some of it is because you are interested in the research side of things, the research in primary care, or having an interest in sustainability, or having an interest in developing EDI work, so equality, diversity, inclusivity work, or it's because you want to work with particular populations. So homeless health being one of the many that are out there. And then the other facet of it is obviously looking at whether in the structure of your working week, is it that you want to work as a salaried doctor? Is it that you want to work as a partner? Because those things look very different as well. They bring on sort of different managerial roles, different aspects that you would be using your sessional time doing. And then I guess another umbrella of that is medical education. That in itself is a whole other gamut of other things that are going on. So I think people say portfolio careers and it sounds very scary because you think, oh, only the top creme de la creme of these people get this dream job. But actually, if you're motivated enough and you have an interest in something, you will find people who are in the same boat as you, or people who have done it before you, or even if they haven't, people who are willing to help you get to that point. And it's about making those networks, seeking those connections, and sort of putting yourself out there a little bit. There are so many opportunities available, be it through fellowships, be it through sort of some extra roles. I'll leave that to Johannes to talk to us about his many hats that he does. But also what you're doing in your day-to-day practice. So for instance, Emma, you asked about palliative care. So I was toying for ages with the idea of a diploma, this, that, the other, and then the pandemic hit and, you know, applications went all funny and I thought, oh, I'm not really sure what to do. And then I started my ST3 job and I had a discussion with my supervisor and I said, you know, that's something I am interested in doing. And he said, well, you can apply to do the diploma once you've qualified. That's perfectly reasonable to do. You don't have to cram everything into that, you know, that short space of being a trainee. It's a career progression over time. So your portfolio that you have when you're on ST1 versus ST3 versus 5 years in the job, 10 years in the job, will be constantly in flux, and you pick up things that you enjoy. But also it's important to drop things that you don't enjoy. And I think sometimes as medics, we have sort of a bit of a complex of not wanting to let things go or not giving up certain things if they're not our skill set, because it looks like failure. But having done that jump from hospital to GP and having certain colleagues go, oh, why did you give up? Well, I didn't give up. I sort of moved to something that suited my skill set better. So there are lots of opportunities for this portfolio working out there. And my main piece of advice is to speak to those who are in training. If there's a particular area you want to be in, speak to your training program directors, get on Twitter, have a look around if that's your thing. If you don't like social media, there are other ways of sort of finding out these things, and get involved with the RCGP. There are some really bright, intelligent, innovative, amazing people who are part of the college that do lots of work that isn't necessarily always front facing, but it is out there, and it's about going and seeking that sort of opportunity. But I will stop blabbering on, so I'm going to let Johannes come in.
Thanks, Mira. Yeah, I think you've probably covered most of the important things that I want to say. I think at the most basic level, you know, when you're in training, you have a portfolio, and that portfolio will make sure that you are engaged in leadership and management activities. It will make sure that you're involved in quality improvement. So, you know, even at the most basic level, you're going to be exposed to a variety of things outside of, you know, simple patient contact. And then beyond that, it's completely up to you. And I think, like Mira said, the most important thing is just to, you know, if you have an interest in something, tell people, tell as many people as you can, because if you tell 100 people, you know, two or three of them are either going to share that interest or have already made some progress in that area and be able to give you some advice. So I think just broadcast your interest. You'll meet really interesting people that way, and you'll find ways that you can, you know, forge your own path in that direction. So again, as Mira said, you know, I was a bit of a keen bean, and in my F2 year, I did a postgraduate certificate in clinical education and a diploma in reproductive and sexual health. And you can follow that track, and there are loads of diplomas that you can do. There's normally funding that you can find while you're a trainee to help you to pursue many of those courses. But I don't think it's necessary to do that. And there are so many other ways that you can forge projects. You can come up with research if you speak to the right people. So again, it just comes back to kind of broadcasting. And in terms of how my week looks, I mean, I'm an academic GP trainee at the moment in ST3. So two of my days each week are dedicated to medical education and primary care research. But on the other days, there's still loads of stuff that probably would seem quite bizarre to a kind of hospital trainee. So my supervisor asked me to block a Wednesday clinic off in a week or two because he's taking me to the garden, and I haven't fully worked out what that means yet, but I'm going to spend an afternoon in the garden doing something about the local community and green projects, which is really nice. And then slightly more medical things, I did a pediatric in-reach clinic last week where a pediatric consultant came in and we ran a clinic together where we kind of take referrals from all of the practices in the PCN and see patients that are maybe, you know, just a bit beyond our level of comfort in terms of managing them, or a little bit complex, or we just want a second opinion. So we still get that really nice interface with secondary care. And we still get to manage some slightly more complicated situations and get to learn from secondary care, which is really rewarding. So there's a huge spectrum of what you can do. You can just stick to the portfolio, and that will still give you a really interesting set of exposures to different ways of living as a GP and working as a GP. Equally, you can do research, you can do diplomas, you can just make contacts with secondary care and work in and out of hospital. And you can also work part-time and do something totally different. And you know, moonlight in something which can be medical or completely non-medical. I think Mira and I know a few people from our VTS who are involved in health tech startups, and they do that part-time and medicine part-time. There's just a huge range of things that you can do, and it really is a malleable career.
Definitely. And I just wanted to quickly chip in as well, just going along with what Johannes has said, but also what I said earlier in the sense of going into a group of one, you know, prospective GP trainees as an ST1, I remember looking around and everybody was very, very different. So there were people who had come from other pathways of training, a few who had come straight from F2, a few who had taken F3s, F4s, all those sorts of things. And everyone had a very different story to tell, but there is an overwhelming sense of belonging. And I think that's it. So when you're thinking about this portfolio career, or you're thinking about having a special interest, or whatever else that it is, it's that it needs to sit well with where you see your journey being, and it factoring in other aspects of your life as well. I think one thing, valuable thing that I've learned from, you know, speaking to supervisors and doing general practice jobs versus my hospital jobs, is that GP is hard work. And there is, I certainly had a misconception before I went into it thinking, I don't know how the clinical side of it will be. I know people are overworked and all of this, but I don't know how it is. And obviously it's inescapable in the media at the moment about the onslaught that general practice is getting. It's really hard and it's hard work, but it's also worthwhile. And there's a differentiation between those two things and recognizing where you need that work-life balance. So, some opportunities are amazing and they shouldn't be turned down. Other opportunities, it's, you know, my words of advice are, is this the best thing for you right now in this stage of your life? Or is this something that may come around again at some point? Obviously, people say, don't lose these opportunities if you can't, you know, if it's a once in a lifetime thing and it's a diploma that you've always wanted, go for it. But these things come in cycles. And for some trainees, when they start GP training, it's about adapting, you know, adapting to the rotas of a hospital job that you may have never done before. It's about adapting to a new way of portfolio because it is different from foundation training. It is different from if you've been in other specialties of training. And exams as well, you know, you can't get through the GP program without passing those exams. So some focus has to be given on all of those things, but it's about just having a long, hard look at what it is that you want, and you can fashion it and the rest will sort of work out.
Thank you both. I think there's some key themes that are coming out from what you're both saying, which are making me very excited about a career in general practice, and that it is what you make it, and there's lots of opportunities and a lot of things you can get involved in, and lots of different types of GPP, but also that as a career it's about it being the right fit for you, and you've had slightly different journeys than we potentially might have, in that we're very keen on it very early in our career, but actually appreciate that lots of our peers are still very unsure about it, although it's one of their considerations. And it's lovely to hear your stories about actually you don't need to know exactly what you want to do. You just need to explore the options, to ask as many questions as possible, to attend as many events as you can. If you have the opportunity to do taster days or to chat to people or to look for opportunities outside and inside the curriculum and your training pathways and the things that are offered to you. But also things like getting involved in the RCGP and getting involved in your faculty boards and getting involved in local events that might be happening. Actually, everybody has a seat on the table and it is a really inclusive community that I felt really part of, even though I'm not a trainee yet, that actually it is a wonderful place to be. I just wondered if you could both expand a little bit on your experiences of training and whether it was different to what you expected. You've touched on a few things like exams, less than full-time, academic. There's lots of things we could go into, but actually just a few of your thoughts or things that you really would like to share with prospective GPs, that would be really lovely, because I think lots of people worry about it perhaps being a lonely career compared to hospital. They're used to the hustle and bustle, which suits some people and really doesn't suit other people, but actually they're used to working in those teams, and that transition from being part of those teams, even in your GP training, to then sitting in a different sort of space with different team members in a practice. Apologies, yeah, so any questions then?
That's right, we will cover them all. So the thing that immediately jumped out to me when you were talking about training, and particularly when you mentioned that sense of community, is the VTS scheme. So Mira and I are on the same VTS. So, you know, our experience is kind of limited to the best VTS in the UK. but it's a really wonderful way of kind of kindling that community and having a support network and a group of people who still have incredibly diverse interests. And are at different stages of training in different practices with different aspirations. But it's just a really nice place and a really nice time for you to come together once a week for half a day, time out of the office, just to kind of share experiences and to offload some of the drama that you've been through in the week before. And I think, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of that was online. And when we finally got to meet each other again in person, it was such a good feeling. And it just reminded you how nice it is to have that community and to have those connections. Aside from that, I mean, going through SD1 and SD2, it feels very much like F1 and F2, just because you're doing rotations through a hospital. So in that sense, it's quite a gentle teaser for GP life, because it feels very much like what you know. And although you have more responsibility, you are kind of familiar with expectations, and things just kind of gradually ramp up. And it's only really, I guess, you know, in your first GP placement, which is maybe a little bit longer for some courses, that you get a flavour of it, but then you get the kind of safety of getting back into hospital. And it just gives you some breathing room and some time to kind of reflect on what you like about each situation. Because for me, there are lots of things that I do love about working in a hospital. And like you say, some of that is the community and working in a team. And being able to go kind of back and forth between hospital jobs and GP jobs, I think, is a really good opportunity to kind of force you to reflect on, you know, how you can make the most of both of those situations, and how you can maybe take some of those things from the hospital experience and bring them into your work as a multifaceted portfolio GP superstar. But yeah, in terms of the training program in general and my expectations, I think it's fairly straightforward. The application is probably the most daunting part, just because, you know, these application processes are always a little bit unnecessarily complicated. But once you're through that, it's fairly straightforward.
So yes, I agree with everything you said, as always. I think for me, when applying for GP training, the things that I would consider are, where in the country do you want to train? Because that has an impact on how the shape of training looks for you in terms of commuting, where the hospitals will be, how far spread apart the GP training will be. So from a practical sort of perspective, you know, how are you going to get there? Do you already have a homestead in a particular location? These things are key to sort of work out early on. And it's about finding out either from someone who's already in that VTS group or getting in touch with the program directors whilst the application windows are open. So I got in touch with our program directors because I didn't really know how the geographical GP patches worked. I live sort of Southeast London. So there's about five VTS schemes in my area that I could have applied to that would have all been much of a muchness in terms of commuting. But by emailing the program directors ahead of time to kind of figure out what the exact patches were, what kinds of jobs were available, were there any other extra things that scheme offered, or speaking to trainees that were in that scheme already, really helped me to sort of hone it down and kind of go, well, actually, I really do want to go here. I think there is this mystery where people go, I just don't know what to expect, but there is information out there. And if you're really wanting to find out about somewhere new, do your best to try and find someone who's already on that scheme. People are willing to share that information and want to help out. So, you know, knowledge is power. So try and get yourself in the best position you possibly can. Obviously, depending on the assessment questionnaire and your interview or whatever else happens. But before you start, you know that, okay, this is where I wanted to be, or this is somewhere where I wanted to be. I'm in a good mind frame for that. As Johanna said, a lot of your hospital secondary care jobs are much like working at any SHO rota. Some of the jobs are hard. Some of the jobs are potentially not as relevant to general practice. But obviously, again, the curriculum is changing, or the shape of GP VTS is changing in the amount of hours in the amount of months allocated to primary care versus secondary care posts. That will vary around your VTS groups. You know, if you've done training beforehand and you're sort of coming to GP after having done a specialty training, being aware of whether you can apply for a 6-month reduction in post, or that you don't do another acute medical job. I didn't end up getting acute medicine again, which was perfect for me, having done so much of it already before. So being aware of those things, I think, is important. If you are doing hospital jobs, obviously there's that team camaraderie. absolutely, it's, you know, the ward rounds, it's doing the, you're having a jobs list, getting that on, hopefully having a really good team that you can socialise with now that, you know, things are hopefully improving with COVID. But from a GP perspective, I would always try and view these jobs through the lens of a GP. What's important? What do these registrars and consultants get referred in all the time that they think actually in general practice, you could maybe try this, this and this, and you can take that away with you and reflect on that, or try and get to clinic, or, you know, try and view that job with a GP lens, although it's not always possible. And then with regards to sort of how training has been, I've really not found GP to be that isolating. And the reason is, I will say, I think COVID in general was very isolating, pardon the pun. And actually having done a hospital job versus being in primary care during the pandemic, I found primary care to be much more cohesive. And I think it's just logistics of where you're working in a practice, the proximity with people, the difference in the PPE that you have to wear. And Emma, you sort of mentioned about teams in secondary care versus it being, you know, you're the sole practitioner in a room consulting with that patient in general practice. I think it varies. I think it's about looking at the journey is always important, but it's really important to look at the destination. So in hospital medicine, look at those consultants and look at the jobs that they are doing on a day-to-day basis. What is their week looking like? Because yes, there is understandably more team related activities, but it's not as much as it is when you're a junior doctor or a registrar in that training pathway. So the destination is you're equating being a general practitioner to being a hospital consultant. That's sort of looking at like for like in the best possible sense. And it's about a culture in the practice that you work at. So some practices have a coffee at 11 o'clock every morning, and it's not about necessarily patient handover or debrief. It's just so that they all see each other. Some go out for an annual, you know, a weekly meal. They'll all, you know, get something from somewhere down the road. Or in some practices, I know people go for a walk because they're signed up to Greener Practice and they're signed up to Park Run and all these other amazing initiatives that are out there that the staff actively want to be involved in as well. So that's to steal, you know, wise words from someone else, be the change you want to see. So if you're in a GP practice and you're finding it a bit isolating, raise it a bit, see if you can change the culture. There will be someone that wants to have a coffee or have a tea. It is different to hospital medicine, undoubtedly, but the more confidence you get, the more you can make it into sort of what you would like to have on a day-to-day basis. And don't eat lunch at your desk on your own if you absolutely don't have to.
Completely agree, Mira. There's one other thing that I want to just throw in, because I think it's really important when you were talking about choosing where you want to be in the UK, particularly if you're coming at GP as a kind of relatively fresh-faced, young, excited medical person. Doctors, that's what we are, isn't it? It's getting too late now. I think you should look at a really good opportunity as well to think about, you know, a three-year stretch of your life when you can just be in a different part of the country, in the same way that lots of people use F1 and F2 just to move away, be somewhere completely different. I think it's a really good opportunity to, you know, live by the sea, or you know, live in remote Scotland and do rural track GP just to get away from it. The GP surgery that I worked at in F2 was full of GPs who would go surfing at lunchtime. And, you know, we worked in a clinic that was essentially on the beach and was opposite an ice cream and pasty shop. You know, think about, you know, not just competing and trying to be, you know, in the center of a big city because that's what seems like the best thing to do. This is a really exciting opportunity just to be somewhere new and explore part of the UK and try something exciting and different. So don't get hooked up on kind of trying to be what you think is the best. Just really embrace the opportunity.
And I think both of you have raised so many points that we can't go into everything you've said. I think the big things that have come up for me is talk to people. Don't be afraid to reach out and emailing as well. Email program directors because they will get back to you. Think practically about where you want to be, what lifestyle you want. But also in terms of the team working and the isolation of GP, it's so varied based on practice. And if you don't like what you see, change it, as you said, Mira, and don't be afraid to change it. Even as a ST2, you can make changes. I just want to quickly touch on Johannes. You mentioned that you were academic GP And I think a lot of people have misconceptions that GP is not an academic career, and they don't really understand what an academic GP actually is. Would you mind just quickly summarising what you do as an academic GP and how academia as a GP varies a bit from hospital academia, or what people might expect academics to do?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, at the most basic level, academic GP training is just doing ST1-2 in the same way that everyone else does. And then you have an ST3 in 4 years. In ST3, you do 40% of your time is research and 60% is clinical. And in ST4, it swaps, so you're kind of 60% doing research and 40% clinical. So it's a really nice way, just from a purely practical point of view, of kind of breaking down your time a little bit, spreading things over a couple of years. It's still really busy, but it just means that the intensity of your patient contact is diluted a little bit, and the intensity of kind of doing research is diluted by your patient contact. So it's just a nice way to spread things out a little bit. In terms of what academic GP actually involves, there are two kind of main streams. One is primary care research, the other is medical education. You're expected to do some research in either stream, but you can kind of tailor it more or less to what you're interested in. And in terms of the actual research that we do, there's a huge range of things that you can cover. There's a really kind of active and vibrant primary care research network who work on some kind of big national studies, thinking about things like the principal trial. And then you can also find someone locally at the local hospital or within the PCN who's just got, you know, a massive passion for something that affects your local community. And you can research that. For me, I'm more focused on the medical education side of things. So I am also doing a master's in education alongside my academic work. And I'm doing some research at the moment into the work of student vaccinators in vaccination centres during the pandemic. But it is, as with everything else in GP, it's a really kind of malleable situation. You come to the programme and you make it what you want it to be. And then in terms of what happens after academic training, many people go on to do a PhD and continue doing primary care research or public health research, because there's a lot of overlap with our public health colleagues. Some people just kind of become the face of research in their practice or in their PCN and are involved in driving research or recruiting people from the patient population onto research trials. But I mean, as I keep saying, it's completely malleable. It's whatever you want it to be. I do think that in GP, you probably have a little bit more control over the research that you do, because in medical specialties, there will be a consultant with an interest who really drives you to kind of research down that route. And in GP, I think if we're not so attached to research, there is just much more freedom to be the change that you want.
Thank you. There's so many things that we could talk about that we haven't talked about: less than full-time trainees, all the other opportunities. There's tons of other stuff, but just perhaps a couple of practical things that people might not be aware of. How does your portfolio work compared to what people might be used to in other specialties as part of the foundation program and the exams? So just a brief summary of how that looked, just to give people a practical thing to take away.
Definitely the least exciting things at the end of the podcast, so if you've stopped listening, it's fine. No, but also very, very important for your training. So in terms of how the portfolio differs to how it is in foundation, I'll confess my foundation portfolio was many eons ago, but in terms of how it's structured, is that it's an online platform, and everything is done online. There's no paper forms or anything like that at all. And in each job that you do, you will have, much like foundation training, you will have a clinical supervisor when you're in hospital, who is usually a consultant in that specialty, and you'll have your educational supervisor, who is a GP, who is either in the ST3 practice that you will be at, or in certain areas it might work slightly differently that you have it, but your educational supervisor will always be a primary care physician. And you have contacts with your education supervisor through your year, and there's expectations. So similar, very similar to foundation training, there's an expectation for case-based discussions and clinical examinations and KECSs and things like that, that there are forms for and you get filled, and there's mandatory amounts of those to be doing within each block. And at the end of the year, you have an ARCP, much like foundation training. The slightly different thing is sort of reflective pieces, or as they call them, learning logs or clinical cases. So there was a huge variety across the country prior to this year as to how many reflective pieces trainees would do. And this has now been standardized across the board. So effectively, 3 reflective pieces a month is what trainees are sort of supposed to be doing. And that's reflecting on things that they've seen in practice and how it fits into the curriculum. So this is why I was saying earlier about trying to see your hospital jobs through a GP lens, because what you're trying to do is reflect on things that you can see that you can then show evidence that you can link that into your curriculum. And it makes life a lot easier for showing evidence and aptitude to a specific thing, so that your supervisor can say, yes, this person has shown that they understand X or they understand Y from this case that they've seen. So there's learning logs that you need to complete, and that's probably the most time consuming part of the portfolio with regards to GP training and sort of linking those adequately. And then there are other things. So much like foundation training, getting multi-source feedback when you're in primary care, getting patient feedback. And that's in ST1 and ST3. In ST3, there's a prescribing assessment, and you have to show an sort of engagement with a quality improvement activity or a quality improvement project throughout all years of training. All of that sort of laid out, and you will be told about all of that in your VTS. And it's about making time through training and trying not to leave it to the end. I'll confess I'm guilty of that quite a lot, and just sort of developing as you go along. With regards to the exams, for to qualify and to work as a fully qualified GP, you need to pass the exam, the MRC GP, and that constitutes of 2 parts. So the first part is the AKT, which is the applied knowledge test. So that's multiple choice that you sit at a centre where you do your driving theory test. And then the second exam, currently due to COVID, the original CSA exam has changed to RCA. These are all 3-letter acronyms that will probably be irrelevant in a couple of years' time, but as it stands for now, the exam is a submission of 13 real life consultations through a variety of media. So face to face, on the phone, or video consultations that you do crossing a breadth of different medical systems or mental health, et cetera, et cetera. And then you submit them and they're marked by examiners. The college are currently in the process of developing a new exam. So watch this space. By the time you get to ST3, that exam will likely have changed. And that is your exit exam. So that's sort of the bare minimum that you need to do to start GP is apply, number one. Start, enjoy, network, make the most of your training, use all those opportunities around you, get through the exams, tick the boxes on the portfolio, and then you'll be pretty much done. It sounds so easy, doesn't it, Johannes?
Almost like a dream.
Thanks for asking these slightly boring but practical questions that not everyone really appreciates or realises what that might look like, because they don't have the same experience and they don't have a rotation in a general practice. Thank you so much for your insights. It's been really useful for us to be able to interview you, and very enjoyable, just to get a feel for what that might look like. And I hope that that helps inform people what if GP is the right fit for them, and how that might look if they choose to pursue that. I'm very excited for a career in general practice.
Yeah, thank you both. It's been a really nice evening, and it's been really nice to take over as well and have the power for a very nice use of power. I just had one question for both of you guys, and thinking to maybe the start of ST1 when you both started GP, what would be your one piece of advice for people starting out in ST1 GP? One thing to take through their GP training.
My ST1 piece of advice is don't stress. I think take your time, get to know people in your VTS, get adjusted to, you know, being a GP trainee, what that means in the context of, you know, VTS teaching, getting used to your portfolio, getting accustomed to this job or a new city if you've moved somewhere. So for that first, you know, first 4 to 6 weeks, just not to stress and just kind of just live life a little bit. And you will then ease into that program and that way of how things work. I can certainly say that was that was the best advice someone gave me, and I definitely followed that. How about you, Johannes?
Yeah, I mean, when the question was asked, the word that comes to mind is relaxed. It's, you know, you've been through a lot. Going through any application process is always a bit stressful. Moving to a new area is stressful. So I definitely think, you know, not taking things too seriously is important. I would say that, just to completely contradict myself now, that SD1 is quite often the time when you have the most breathing room. So don't necessarily fill that time up with things, but do use it as a kind of breathing space to kind of really actively look at what's around you, think about your future, think about what you would maybe like to do things over the next few years and in your future career. Just be really aware of the opportunities that are around you. And also kind of try and embed yourself into your community that you live in and that you work in. Find activities that you can do when you do have a long, stressful day. You know, make friends that you can complain to after a long day. And just focus on making yourself happy in the place that you're in as well, because that will make your work so much easier and more rewarding.
Absolutely. And I guess one of the common themes that you will have heard in a lot of the RCGP work that was done last year, the year before, in our podcast, is this concept of community. You're joining a fantastic community of colleagues, patients, general population, and lots of things are going on. Definitely do all those things that Johanna said, and make sure that you have that time to reflect on what's going on around you. And there are things available for you to get involved with. Sometimes the hardest thing is making that first step, sending that first email, retweeting that first thing, whatever it is for you that you think, oh, but once you've done it, you'll feel so much better for having made that connection, because you don't know what that then subsequently might lead on to. You know, as a slight plug from Johannes and us, myself, is get involved as an AIT, become a rep for your local VTS, join the BMA if that's your thing, you know, their committee that sits there, join things that are going on with the RCGP, come and join our podcast, you can get involved in other things like the LMC, academic things. So there's lots of networks out there, there's lots of things where you can sit as a representative or as an observer, and the only question is that you just need to go and seek out those opportunities.
Equally, if you just want to get a puppy and a glass of wine, also a great choice.
Brilliant. Thank you both. I haven't got any more questions, but I just want to say a huge thank you for giving up your evening tonight. It's been great to chat to you and we really appreciate it. And hopefully anyone now who's listening, who's thinking, oh, should I not go for GP? Hopefully we've managed to sway you that GP is the way forward. If not now, then in the future, maybe you'll see the light.
I certainly hope so. Well, I think all that's left for me to say is thank you to Bex and Emma for taking the lead on this podcast. It's been very nice for Johannes and I to sort of ramble on and answer questions. I think that's what we do anyway, but, you know, it's fine. But we definitely don't need to prolong this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Hopefully you will all choose GP. And in terms of the podcast, Watch This Space, we are hoping for some new podcast host additions for future episodes, aren't we, Johannes?
We are. We are very excited about, again, being able to relax a little bit and sit back and listen to other people take control.
Exactly. So thank you for listening. I hope everyone here has enjoyed this episode of Somewhere in Between, the RCGP podcast for AITs and early career GPs. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Personal favourite part was Johannes forgetting the word doctor.